Hello and welcome to episode 11 of the Derailed Podcast. I'm Chris.
And I'm Fred.
And we've got a few things we wanted to discuss today. Mm-hmm. So first up, we replayed 1846.
Yes.
Which is something we've been wanting to do for a while because we kind of played it when we were very green, new to the whole thing.
The first one we played, and then we played it again a little bit afterwards. I don't know if we played anything else in between.
We haven't played much of it.
No.
We sort of played it when we were still very new, and then I remember we had this big conversation about how terrible our strategy in it was, and then we laughed about that, and ever since then we'd kind of wanted to play it again to sort of revisit that.
Yes.
And I must say that I feel like we definitely have more experience now than we did then.
Yeah.
So I say like when we were less experienced, and I'm almost kind of joking, but not really, because I can feel these days when we play that we have evolved as players and we are thinking about things differently.
Yes, I wouldn't call myself experienced yet, but I do have a little more experience than I did last time.
There yet, but I think we've made pretty big strides in terms of how we think about these games and how we approach these games. Or at least I'd like to think so.
Yeah.
And it was very interesting to play 1846 again with those kinds of new perspectives. So we'll discuss that. I also want to chat a little bit about a bit of strategy stuff.
Okay.
My educator and schooler JC Lawrence has been teaching me stuff again.
Mm-hmm.
And he often refers to two types of strategies that he refers to as a capital control game and a capital destruction game.
Okay.
And I thought they were kind of interesting to talk about. I was chatting to him a little bit about it, and I think I kind of got the basics of it. It's something I'd like to probably revisit again in the future.
Okay.
But I thought interesting to sort of outline generally how those work and potentially something you could try in your next game.
Yes.
Yeah. Specifically, these kinds of strategies are for games with sort of like 2D stock markets. So stuff like 1830 or 1889, where there's sort of an up and down movement and a left to right movement in the stock market.
Yeah.
I guess you could call them relatively stock focused in some way.
Okay.
As I think a lot of these games tend to become, the more you play them, that stock round becomes more and more important, I think. Mm. And then other than that, we've got a South Africanism for you, which I've turned into kind of a mini game. So I think that one would be quite fun. So we'll give that a try.
Okay.
And first up is emails. We have to give a special shout out this week to Niels from Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Niels, we're talking about you. So this was a really, really funny email that we got that we both really, really liked. So Niels' wife, Nila, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, messaged me and she told me quite a funny story, so I thought it would be fun to share.
Yes.
So Fred, you've heard this story, but essentially what happened was Nila's husband bought 18 Rhineland, and they just recently got into 18XX themselves, and he said to her, are you keen? I think we should play 18 Rhineland next. I'm keen to try it. And she said, are you sure? I feel like that one might have a little bit too much chrome for us. And obviously that terminology was something that she'd heard on the podcast, and he gave her kind of a funny look and he said, have you been listening to the Derailed podcast? And it turned out they both kind of started listening to it at the same time and hadn't chatted to each other about it yet.
Each other knowing.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So we really, really liked that story. That was super fun. Yes. Nila asked us to give her amazing husband Niels a shout out.
Yes. Yeah,
just to say thank you to him for sort of bringing her into this world of trains and heavy thinking.
Yeah, well, I think it's kind of a shout out to both of them.
Yes, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But yeah, she thought it'd be fun to surprise him.
Yes,
so
there you go, that's Niels. Very cool.
Yeah. Other than that, it's been a bit quiet. I mean, I posted something on Twitter about 1846. We got quite a lot of feedback on that. Actually, a lot of people agreeing with what I posted.
Mm.
Maybe without spoiling that, perhaps we can launch into kind of our perspectives on that.
On 1846.
On that play. Yeah. So what were your kind of, I guess, first impressions or takeaways, or what did you leave thinking about?
I was happy to play it again, but playing it again, it definitely felt, I don't know, like it felt like there was something lacking.
Yeah, it was almost like a bit of a letdown.
Yes, yeah. It was still enjoyable. I still enjoyed it. I will play it again. We played it because we played with two players who'd never played any 18XX before.
Right.
So we thought, since we wanted to play 1846 again, and it's a fairly decent introductory one, we'd give it a try. And I think they both enjoyed it.
Very much so. Yeah, yes. They definitely did. And as did we the first time we played it.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So it was maybe less enjoyable for us now that we've had some more experience with other 18XXs and we've seen the other possibilities. Yeah, the stock part of it definitely felt like there was a lot less to it in this one.
Yeah, I think, you know, I felt a little bit disappointed, almost like a little bit let down, because I kind of was going in there like, I'm going to do something different. I'm going to approach this game differently. And it kind of felt like I never really had the opportunity to do that.
Yes, you kind of, you just have to run a good company in order to do well in that game. You can't really do like veer off too much from that.
No, and I kind of got, I got the Grand Trunk Railway, which is this orange railroad that runs at the top. And I got a private that lets me add to a port value. And I just added a fat bonus to a port that was right next to it and linked up with that and then ran that route across. And I bought a bunch of trains and my income was absurd very early. People were paying out revenues of like 40 when I was paying out 170 or something. Yes. It was really, there was a huge discrepancy at the beginning.
Yes.
And so as much as I wanted to kind of be like, yeah, let me like sell this down and like start something new, there was really no incentive to do that because my stock was leaping up. I hit double jump territory very quickly. Mm. It would go up twice. And so there was really no incentive to ever really divest out of that company.
No.
And there was very little opportunity to float a new company as well, because I kind of had to spend my money buying up as much shares of that company as I could, because it was so obvious that it was great and would continue to be great that I wanted to own a large percentage of it before other people could, essentially.
Yeah.
Which was, I don't know, kind of boring in a way.
Yeah, it was. When you started buying up that company, I this time jumped in and started buying it up as well.
Yeah.
Because in previous games, I think one of the mistakes I'd make was to let you get ahead in a well-performing company. So this time I tried to keep up. And I think, so one of the other players bought a share in it as well, if I remember correctly. I had 40%, you had 50%, and there was one other share by one of the other players.
Yes, yeah.
So that kept your advantage in that company down a bit, even though, I mean, you still gain one share's worth every operating round. So, yes, yeah, at least it was kept in check a little bit.
So I think what was interesting, having played other games, is now when I was looking at this game, I was sort of comparing it a lot.
Mm.
So I looked and I thought, oh, these trains are safe for a really, really long time.
Mm.
Like the two trains, there's much less jumps between the trains in 46.
Mm.
So your two trains last for quite a long time. I mean, if people aren't pushing the trains very quickly, and people weren't, which is kind of always the case with newer players, and I wasn't really incentivized to do so because my trains were incredible and my company was amazing and all of that. And even floating a new company wasn't really very attractive.
Okay, yeah.
Because I didn't really have the money because I'd had to invest it all into my company and my stock price was so high. So I found that there's a lot in 46 that softens the edges.
Mm.
And I think that's part of why it's good for new players.
Mm.
There's not this like brutal train rush. It's very hard to go bankrupt.
Yes.
And I find in other games like 89 or 1830, companies get a big boost and they do a lot of stuff. And then they kind of stop performing, right? Mm. There's a real drop off and a real kind of slump. And in 46, it never felt like that. It felt like the same company that you floated at the beginning will continue to perform really well all the way until the end.
Yes.
So there was never any like maneuvering in terms of let me get out of this company and get into something else because this one's about to kind of go bust.
Mm.
There was none of that tension or that pressure.
Yes.
And I never felt under any pressure at all.
No.
I mean, I double jumped my stock price a couple of times. Then I just filled my coffers with money because everyone was buying my shares. I could afford a permanent train really easily if I wanted to.
Yes.
So I didn't have to really worry about anything.
Yeah. Yeah, I felt the same. There wasn't really any pressure except that I kind of saw that you had that good performing company and I was trying everything to kind of keep up.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, you did end up winning that game, which was good. But I also felt like, so there was definitely a lot more about the track layout, the tiles. We didn't really have tile scarcity in this one, although a couple of times there was like one tile that someone wanted that wasn't quite available.
But there was a couple of green ones.
Yeah, there was always something else that they could do. But I think one of the things you did well in this game was to look at the board and see potential for companies. So the second company, you didn't actually float it. It was floated by someone else and you just took it over by buying more shares, which was a good play. I did the same thing with a different company. But what you did well was to look at the company you ended up investing in and seeing that it had a lot of potential on the board. Even though it might not have been doing that well at the moment, it did have a lot of potential, which I was kind of not paying too much attention to that, like less than I should have. I was more just looking at stocks more, which is a mistake, I think, in 46. Yeah,
I think in 46 particularly, I don't know, I think it's so much about the map. and the routes that, that those companies are going to run. Because once they've got one good route, it seems to kind of, they seem to kind of always perform well.
Yes.
I, like a lot of them have a whole bunch of stations.
Yeah, they do. Most of them had
a, most of them have few, like a lot of stations. I think I got away with a little bit more than I should have with my stations. I think that experienced players would have tokened me out a little bit harder. Because Grand Trunk only has three, which in that game is not very many.
Okay.
Because like Pennsylvania and New York have like five or something. And I think there were opportunities potentially to block my routes that I was trying to, I was constantly trying to build alternative routes for that eventuality, but that eventuality didn't actually happen.
Okay, yes.
Yeah. So a lot of my focus was on that, but it ended up not amounting to anything really.
Right.
But yeah, so you're right. I never floated another company. That's something that stuck out to me as well. I realized that between four players, there were only six companies. And you actually remove companies. So we removed one because there was only, but that also then means that, you know, there's only two people who are ever going to have two companies and everyone else is going to have one.
Yes.
And that's what happened with me. I was just like, okay, well, I'll just, I'll keep chugging along with this one.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's fun in that there's a nice feedback loop of kind of like you just get more and more money. But I found myself wanting to be like tricky.
Right.
Yeah. And not being able to be tricky. You know, I was like, I want to dump this thing on Fred and float this other, and I just, there was nothing to float and there was nothing worth dumping.
Yes.
And yeah, and it's not, it's not all about like pump and dump, right? That's not like the only other complexity the 18xx adds. It just felt like very, very kind of on rails. It was very linear. It was very much like, I've started this company, it's doing really well, I can easily see how it's going to continue to do well, and I'll keep working towards that. And other than that, I'll just buy some shares that I feel like are performing well. I don't know. See, the thing is, I'm kind of sound like I'm poo-pooing it more than it was. Like, it wasn't an unfun experience.
Right. Yes.
It was fun and I was engaged the whole time.
Yes.
It wasn't like I was totally on autopilot, because the nice thing about 18xx is you're always looking at other people's stocks. You're always looking at the map. Like you said, I took over that guy's company, which I think was potentially a winning move. It did a lot for me in the short time that the game had left.
Yeah.
I think I triple jumped that stock as well, and I had 60% of it. So it was definitely good. And stuff like that is cool. It's just that, I don't know, just felt like it was missing the extra levers to pull, the extra stuff to do.
Yes.
There were often times where I took my turn and I was like, I want to do something else, but I can't. So I guess I'll just upgrade this route for another 10 and run it for another billion and, you know.
Yeah. 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 And I think it's still a fine game, especially from a new player's point of view, because from their point of view, there were so many new things, like things they'd never seen in the game. Whereas we've seen them before. So we kind of like have the, you know, like time to think about other potential things we would like to do, but we're just not able to do it in that one. But when you're new, there's so much new to it that it's still a good game, I think.
Yeah. So some people call it quite Euro-y in a way, and JC Lawrence likes to disparagingly refer to it as 18xx, the Euro game.
Okay.
And I can really kind of see that perspective now. And I think that's what's missing from it, is that it does feel like a Euro game.
Right.
It feels like you're playing like a Railways of the World or something, which is another game that I love, but it doesn't give me the same feeling as 18xx.
Yes.
And I think it's lacking that. You know, one of the things that we've always loved about 18xx is that your company is not your company. You're just the one controlling it at the time.
Yes.
Right. We always talk about that. Like, it's very fluid, and in no other game do you have a player board and then that player board just gets taken away from you at some point.
Yeah.
You know, or you just hand it over to someone else and take something new.
Yeah.
That's very unique to 18xx. But this game doesn't give you a lot of that, because it kind of felt like Grand Trunk was my player board and I could never get rid of it.
Yes.
Unless I wanted to basically throw the game.
But you didn't want to get rid of it either. So
exactly.
So for both of us, I think that was the case. Like, you floated a company, I floated a company, and we both held on to those companies until the end of the game. The other two players each floated a company as well. There were some, there was some movement there. Like, I took over one, you took over one, and I think one of them also moved between the two of them at one stage, I think.
Yeah.
But between you and I, nothing really happened. There were no interesting stock things happening between the two of us, I don't think.
Yeah, that's kind of the thing, you know. And I think a lot of that was down to their inexperience as well. They got outmaneuvered in the stock rounds and stuff like that because they didn't really understand all the nuances. So we kind of punished them a little bit and took over their companies and stuff like that. But that's how you learn.
Yes. Yeah,
you know, they still had fun. But I remember one moment where, you know, I realized that the one guy, and we were playing with his wife, I realized his wife could dump the company on him. And I was like, he's going to go bankrupt.
Yes.
He's going to be totally screwed. Like, he's going to have to buy permanent for like 800 because he won't even be able to get the cheap ones. He's got one garbage train in there that's about to be rusted. This is a disaster, you know? And I don't know. It was so weird because she dumped it on him because I told her this because I was just like, I was trying to show them how all the different things of the game works. And then I felt kind of bad. I was like, shit, maybe I shouldn't have told her that. But it was kind of, it's kind of fun to, for people to see how this stuff works. Like, you know, so with learning games. But I was giving everyone advice. So I guess it was fair. But anyway, she did it. And I was like, oh, he's going to be so screwed. And then with like some miserable four train or something, like some really crappy train, he ran a route for like 350 or some insane number and withheld and like chipped in like $400 from his personal, didn't have to sell a single share.
And he was fine.
And he was fine. Yeah. And I was like, this is ridiculous.
Yeah.
I was like, if this was 89, this guy would be bankrupt.
Yes.
Or like very close to it.
But maybe that's a good thing for a first time player, because maybe if he did go bankrupt, he would have a bit of a sour experience with the game. I don't know.
Yeah. No, I get that perspective, but for me it was just like, what am I playing? What is this? This is an 18XX. Like, what is happening here? He should have been toast. You know, because I was using my experience in other games, and if someone had put themselves, because I mean, he never should have been in that position. Like, it was a terrible position to be in. That treasury was like empty. It had a rubbish train in it. It was a disastrous position.
Yeah, but I think you were right to point it out, because that shows them how they should be paying attention to shares and things like that. Because she could only do that because he had 20% of the company. If he saw that coming, he could have easily sold earlier in the game and have been fine. So I think it's fine to point it out. And it's now we know it's also safe to point it out in 46, because chances are the person won't go bankrupt. They'll just learn a valuable 18XX lesson.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I mean, I think it's all good and well for a learning game, because I mean, we knew by that point that neither of them was going to win.
Yeah.
And I also think that sometimes I've heard people say that 46 can be a little bit predictable in terms of its end game or in terms of who's going to win.
Right.
That it's all about shares and nothing else. I don't really know if that's true. You know, people have gone so far as to say that if you look at the second stock round, whoever has the most share certificates has won. You might as well call it there. I don't know if that's true, but I can also see how it can be true because all the stocks perform well.
Right.
Some do perform better than others, but for the most part, they're all moving up. Like, the companies never go bad, you know, so just having a share advantage.
Yeah. Well, if we do get to play it again, we should try and keep that in mind. And just at the end of the stock round, make a note of, you know, who has how many shares and then compare that to the end of the game results.
But will we play it again, Fred? Is the real question.
Maybe with new players. I don't know.
Well, this is something else I wanted to ask you, right? Because we spoke about 46 in the context of a new player game.
Yes.
And we kind of landed on the recommended first player games kind of being either 46 or 89, and then probably Chesapeake when that comes out as well. Probably going to be a good first player experience. What are your thoughts on that? Having played it again,
I think it's still fine for a first game. I'm really curious to see Chesapeake though, so I'll kind of withhold judgment until I play that one. But I think it's still a fine game for new players. It's actually quite nice that companies float immediately, so players can feel that they're involved in the game immediately. Whereas I don't mind only having shares the first two operating rounds and not operating anything. I think a new player kind of wants to become involved and play 18XX, you know?
Right.
So I think it's good that it floats immediately and they can get involved straight away.
Yeah, it's interesting because so a lot of the criticisms about 46 are that, you know, the old adage people say is that it doesn't teach you how to play 18XX, it teaches you how to play 46. Because 46 is quite different, and a lot of things are actually quite different from the basic 18XX kind of system.
Right.
Like if you went from 46 to like 1830, which is kind of like the classic, there's a lot of stuff you'd have to kind of unlearn, a lot of stuff that works differently. So that's part of what people poo-poo about it as a learning game, right? But we've kind of been over that. what it is good as a learning game is that it's a very soft around the edges experience. Yes. And I must say, when we were playing it, I was viewing it from that perspective and I was thinking about all the things that were so good for like learning game stuff, like how simple the trains are, how simple the stock market is. Yeah, like kind of how sort of soft and everything is and how obvious everything is. You know, like you've always said, it makes more thematic sense to you that the company owns the shares and then you pay and then the company goes to the treasury. And yeah, so a lot of it felt very kind of beginner friendly. But then I was like, I don't know, because now if people are asking me like which 18xx should they buy for their first 18xx, we've played 46 three times and now I'm like, I'd kind of be pretty okay with never playing it again, right?
Okay.
Whereas for me, and I would play it again,
right?
But now we have all these other ones and I'd feel like I'd almost always rather play one of those.
Okay, yes.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
So for me, one of the great things about 18xx is you can play it like 200 times and you will still be unlocking stuff and never getting bored of stuff. If someone bought 1830, for example, as their first, they could play that game forever.
Yes, yeah.
That no, could I be agree the with only that. Game they played for the rest of their life and they'd be fine. Mm. And I kind of don't feel that way about 46. I'm a bit like...
Yeah.
It feels like someone playing like Catan or Ticket to Ride or something and now they're like, okay, now I'm ready for a real game.
You know?
And it feels like a bit like that, like my first 18xx.
Yes. No, I can see that and I agree with that as well. The one thing I would just say is that when teaching 18xx to a brand new player who's never played it before, it's a lot for them to take in. So it's stock round, it's buying and selling shares, it's laying tiles, it's upgrading tiles. Even that, which is a simple thing once you're used to 18xx, like just the rules of how a tile lay is allowed to go and how upgrades work. Like you can't just build a green tile slave straight away. You have to build a yellow tile first and then a green tile. Like all of those are simple little things, but they add up. And it, for a new player, for a first-time player, it's a lot to take in. And I think 1846 still teaches you all of those things. Like it still teaches you the basics of how a stock round goes, how what private companies are, how tile lays work, how to run routes, how not to repeat track when running routes, because that's another thing that people can struggle with sometimes. So it still teaches you all of that, those things, while still keeping the stock shenanigans simplified, I think.
Right.
So I think it's still a fine base to build on. I think you can teach someone 1846 and then a full cap 18xx after that with a proper 2D stock grid and everything. And then all you have to explain is the new stock grid, basically. So I think it's still a fine basis to build on.
Yeah, I don't think it's bad. I just think I'm now more inclined to say I'd rather recommend like 89.
Okay.
Yeah. I feel like you'd get more value out of it in a way.
To buy. Yes, I agree with that.
Yeah.
But if we have 1846, so I would still feel fine playing that with someone who's played it for the first time. I probably wouldn't recommend them buying it. I would say play my 1846. See whether you like 18xx, and then if you want to buy something, maybe what Chesapeake or whatever.
It also has the value of like, I want to say availability, and it's a nice production.
Yes.
It feels like a board game.
Yes.
Like 89 is hard to get now because all the board is not really doing that as much anymore. I think they're going to go back to it at some point. But even then, it's more complicated getting it from all aboard. It's very expensive.
Yeah.
You get this like print and play thing. You might be like, what the hell is this?
Yeah.
You know, that kind of stuff. Whereas 46 feels more like a boxed board game.
Yeah.
And you can buy it on like Amazon.
Or you could just go even in South Africa on a local online store and buy it and have it delivered to your house.
Yes.
Which you can't with them.
That's the gap that I'm hoping Chesapeake will fill.
Yeah.
I am happy for Chesapeake to be the new, this is the introductory.
Yes.
So because they're doing a Kickstarter and retail and all that stuff, I hope it gets like a big wide release and it becomes very available and they do multiple print runs. Because I think it's going to be great for that. Because it's basically like 89. It's a similar thing, right? It's 1830 basic rule set with like kind of a smaller map and a bit more stripped down.
Yeah.
And it's just got that little mechanism that helps push the trains faster, which is a nice touch
as
well. So yeah, I think that Chesapeake is going to be the new king.
Yeah. And no, I fully expect it to be as well, yes.
Yeah, and I think I'd kind of welcome that.
Yeah.
So where are you on playing 46 again? Like,
let me put it this way. So we did our top five previously.
Right.
And I'd kind of decided, so I spoke to you after we played it afterwards, and I said to you at the time that I think I will only ever move an 18XX up one spot in my top five.
Right.
Because I've had so few plays of all of them. I don't think it's fair to play an 18XX now after I've got a top five and put it at the top right away. I think all of my top games need to be played a bit more. So I'll only make it, like, move it up one. I've since decided that I'll also move games down one spot. Okay. So I have decided to move 1846 down one spot on my top five. So that moves it down to four.
Wow.
Yeah. And you, it was five, fifth in yours.
It was sixth already.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
Or did you move the other one we played?
Yeah. Into fifth? I put 49 above it.
Right.
Okay. Because, and it was because I felt like I'm going to like 49 more with more plays.
Yes.
It was kind of based on that.
Yes.
I had a feeling that when we went back to 46, I was going to be like, eh.
Yeah.
But I must say, I actually, and this sounds strong, but it's not meant to, but I want to say I disliked it more than I expected to.
Okay.
I thought that I was going to be like, yeah, this isn't my favorite.
Yeah.
But now I'm kind of like, ugh.
Yeah.
You know, like,
Okay.
Yeah. I had quite a strong negative feeling towards it in spite of really enjoying myself.
Right.
Which is probably testament to how good these games are.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, I'd play 46 over a lot of games.
Yes.
But I wouldn't play it over any other 18XX game
right now. Okay.
So it's at the bottom of 18XX games for
okay.
me. So how does this thing work, right? When you say you move them down one at a time,
yes,
is that like per week?
No, so per like so 1830 is now number five. Well, it was number five anyway, but I've basically swapped 89 and 46. So 46 is fourth, and 89 is now third. So if I play 1830 now, then I'm allowed to move it up one again if I enjoyed it more than my 46 play. Which I
feel like
will.
I feel like 46 is going to be very unfairly sitting at fourth for a long time.
No, well, we just need to play some other games that bubble their way up.
I feel like you created this list based on a faulty perception of what 46 was.
Do you know Bubble Sort?
No.
Okay, Bubble Sort is a sorting algorithm in computer science. This is basically effectively a bubble sort.
Okay.
Things just swap places, move up one down, one or down.
Right.
So it's probably will bubble its way down. Other things will bubble up past it.
Are you counting our online play of 1830?
Oh, good question.
I think for the purposes of knocking 1846 further down, you should count.
I don't know. It feels like I shouldn't instinctively. I don't know why. Maybe I should. I'll think about it. I'll think about it. Yeah.
So that's the other thing. We've started our first online game of 18XX on rr18xx.com. Mm. We're actually playing with a couple of listeners, which is really cool.
Yeah, very cool. Yeah.
Yeah, they messaged us and said, hey, you guys mentioned wanting to try it. Let's set up a game. So we were like, yeah, we're in.
Yeah, awesome.
So we're currently getting crushed, I feel like.
Mm.
We've just done the private auction.
Yes.
Yeah. And remember, I said, so the one guy, Per, he bought the, I can't remember what it's called.
The private that gives you 10%.
I think it's like the CNA or something like that. Camden and Amboy, maybe something like that. But he bought the private that gives you 10% of Pennsylvania Railroad.
Right.
And then I saw to my horror, because I was bidding for him against it. I bid 165 and he went straight to 200.
Yes, I saw that.
And I was like, yo, this is big gun stuff.
Yeah.
There's stuff here that I don't understand. I had a feeling that I should fight him for it, but I didn't, because I thought you were priority deal.
For some reason,
because you selected auction first, eh?
Only because whoever was first put a bid on a later private.
You see.
So I bought the top one available. I just bought it at face value.
So I wasn't paying enough attention, and I was going to message you because I thought you were priority, and I was going to sneakily message you and be like, okay, Fred, don't let Per float the Pennsylvania Railroad, okay? I think it's really bad if you let him have that and that. And then I saw Per was first and in the priority. I was like, oh, no. And I said to you, he's going to float the PRR. And what did he do?
Well, I haven't checked today. Did he float?
First action, okay. President right. share the PRR. But I've got a plan.
Okay.
I've got a plan to take
well,
down.
Well, don't tell him.
No. Per might be listening. Per, listen. Don't worry about my plans, buddy. Don't worry about it. Don't you worry about a thing.
It's a decoy plan.
Exactly.
There's no plan.
But yeah, it's super fun and super cool. So if anyone else is keen to have a game with us, I'm sure we definitely will be keen after this one. Yeah, it's quite cool. It's quite a cool interface, actually. It took me like a couple of minutes to kind of figure out what was going on, but yeah, it works pretty well.
Yeah, yeah, it seems fine. Like,
I like that it does all the rules and stuff for you.
Yes, and you can instantly see where all the money is, which is nice.
Yes, yeah, yeah. So it's nice in terms of stats and stuff like that,
yeah.
Which I think is helpful when you're playing a game over like 2 weeks or whatever.
Yes,
yeah. Because yeah, it's hard to keep track otherwise. If you don't have all
and
that stuff.
And it's also got a full history. At the top there, I don't know if you saw every action taken, it's got a history of. So you can scroll back on that if you want to.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so there's Board 18 as well, which is another online site, but that one doesn't do rules. So you have to, the players are forced to kind of manage the rules themselves. I haven't played it myself. I haven't tried it either. But I'm a bit skeptical of having to manage my own rules.
Yes. Yeah, so it's basically an interface to move pieces around, if I understand it
correctly. Right, yeah.
And other players will have to point out, no, you can't actually move that there, or you can't actually take that chair or something. I don't know.
Yes, yeah. Which would be fine in titles that I have experience with, but I'm kind of keen to try out some stuff that I don't have experience with. Yes. So.
Yeah,
so that's another fun thing that we're up to.
Yes.
Yeah, so we were talking lists. So 46 is staying firm at number 6.
Yeah, it didn't make it to back up to 5 on yours.
It did not make it back up to 5. It did Fair not enough. Bubble its way up. No, definitely not.
Okay.
If I could put it lower, I would. No, shame. I'm being rude about it. But it's a fun game. It's
You're
a fun game.
You're
going
to put it at 11 on your top 5. Yeah,
exactly. Oh, that's terrible. Oh, but we are playing a new game on Saturday, which I'm pretty excited about.
Yes.
We're playing 1847 Anniversary Edition.
Right.
So this is another one from Marflow. And I feel like it's kind of a hidden gem. I don't know. I'm quite stoked with it. So I kind of ordered it because it's another one that plays in a reasonable amount of time and got some people recommended it. But it's actually quite cool because it actually has 3 different games in the box, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're basically variations on the same game, but essentially it started out as this 1847 P-Fals. How the hell do you pronounce P-F-A-L-Z?
False.
You just
I would think it's false.
Yeah.
Silent P.
False. Nila, help me out here. You're German. Yeah, so it's got the original of that, and then it's got the sort of updated anniversary edition where you changed a bunch of stuff and sort of reworked it that came out in 2015. And Wolfram, the guy who designs these games, does this a lot. So oftentimes, like, one of his new games will go through multiple editions.
Right.
So you'll end up buying like the 3rd or 4th edition of something because he kind of fixes things or balances things or changes the rules or whatever the case, kind of like develops it over time.
Oils the levers.
Yeah. So it's always kind of cool to get the one that's like late in the process rather than early in the process.
Right.
Yeah. So it's got the original, it's got the anniversary edition, and then it's also got this alternative version that was developed by a group of German 18XX players.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. So I think maybe it's his group that he plays with. I'm not sure. But they put a thing in there saying that these guys are very experienced and they've been playing for like 20 years or whatever, blah, blah, blah. And this was some version of it that they kind of developed themselves.
Wow.
So the thing actually comes with 3 different maps in it.
Mm.
A lot of the components are double-sided, so you use this side for this game and this side for this game. Okay. So it's actually quite cool. There's a lot to explore there, but we'll just play the basic anniversary edition,
I think, on Saturday. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, so you should hear about that one in the next episode.
And it'll be 5 of us playing, right?
Is it 5? Oh, it is 5.
Yumi, Simon, and 2 people they've played 1846.
I think they said they played 46 and 89. Or was it 89 and 30 they've played.
Oh, 89 and 30 they've played.
Yeah. Okay. So I think we were going to play 46 with them.
Yes.
And then we played 46 and we're like, never mind. And then this package
new one came.
Yeah. Came through customs quickly. So yeah, good stuff.
Just in time.
Yeah. So pretty excited about that. So you'll be hearing about that next week.
That should be cool. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Freddie, ready to get schooled?
Okay.
I'm going to teach you some stuff.
Bring it.
I lied. JC's going to teach you some stuff.
Right. Oh, strategy. I thought you were going to teach me Afrikaans. Okay. Strategy first.
Yeah, strategy first. So I thought I'd just touch on this a little bit because I thought it was quite interesting and I think it gives you something to potentially think about or try in your next games. So these are strategies that I feel like specifically are for, I want to say with 1830s style stock markets. So sort of 2D where you can drop stock prices and things like that. Where you float at particular amounts and full cap games, all that kind of stuff. So
So
I'll use sort of 1830-ish as kind of the baseline here. We were talking about 2 different strategies, one being capital control and one being capital destruction. And so I've kind of framed these in my mind. I don't know if people would agree or disagree with this, but it's almost like offensive strategies, where if you consider a defensive 18xx strategy to be going through the normal motions of kind of like floating a company, raising the value of your stocks, making good investments, that'd be kind of a defensive strategy, right? It's you are trying to better your own position. Both of these strategies are almost an attack on the other players.
Okay.
I would say to a large extent.
Okay.
Even though they function differently, that was kind of the common thread that I kind of pulled through them.
Okay. So if I'm understanding you correctly, like the defensive strategy you're saying is kind of like you're trying to win the game by doing well yourself.
Yes.
Instead of necessarily making other players do badly.
Right. And I think there's always an element of, you know, if you have an opportunity to worsen someone else's position, you do in 18xx. But these strategies seem designed specifically to take control of the game in a very particular way.
Okay.
That's where I kind of see it as offensive in a way. You're trying to seize control of the game and sort of push other people out in different ways. But the way you go about it is different. So that hence capital control versus capital destruction.
Okay.
So a capital control game is one in which you are attempting to basically control the flow of capital in the game. That doesn't mean having the most money. It means controlling the most money.
Okay, when you say a capital control game, do you mean like a specific 18xx is always more of a capital control game? Or is that like this is, you're deciding how to play this game?
Yes, yeah,
this exactly. is your strategy for the game.
So different 18xx's can lend themselves to having the possibility of this strategy,
okay.
but this is a strategy, not a design.
Okay,
if that makes sense.
And you can use both strategies in.
Yes, so 1830 I'll use as the baseline example since most games are kind of built on that, and both these strategies you can use effectively in 1830.
Okay, gotcha.
Okay, so capital control would be you are trying to control the flow of money, of capital in the game, right? Okay. So that does not mean that you have the most personal cash. It means that you are controlling the capital. Capital in this case being stuff like the money in companies, how fast the trains are going, things like that, right? So I think it's easier to kind of illustrate with an example. So an example of this would be I float a company for whatever amount, let's say kind of a median amount, right? I will buy up a bunch of stuff. I'll spend all the money from that company that I can as quickly as possible. So just burn through the trains, lay track, buy my own privates up and just get money back and so on. Just loot that company extremely quickly. Immediately sell it down in the next stock round to just the presidency. Immediately float another company and do the same thing again.
Okay.
So this puts people on the back foot because everyone, you're basically drastically accelerating the pace of the game while essentially controlling the money. Because people, you can potentially be floating three companies, whereas other people only have like one or so each, right? And now they're getting stuck because now you're pushing trains, you're trying to rush their trains as quickly as possible, and they don't have the same access to capital that you have.
Right.
You are controlling the vast majority of the capital that's in the game.
Okay.
So if you have three floated companies and you're floating them for higher amounts each time, let's say, then you have a huge amount of the bank's capital. And you also have a huge amount essentially of the available capital in the game. Because let's say you're playing like a four-player game and you've floated like three companies. Other people can't necessarily afford to float a company. They are struggling, or maybe they can, but they've kind of stuck with this one. They haven't sold down in time, whatever the case may be, right? So you have basically massively controlled the amount of capital in the game.
Okay.
So that's where people can then get stuck.
Right.
Quite quickly because
have a lot of options because they've only got the one company to work with.
Exactly.
And so on. Okay.
So you control a huge amount of money and you use that money to basically worsen other people's positions.
Yes.
So it's about having kind of the most money in the game.
Okay.
Controlling the most amount of money.
Okay.
And leveraging that to then put the other players in a tough spot where they all do not have access to a lot of capital.
Right.
Okay. But you do.
Mm.
Yeah. So you can see how this would essentially, you could force the trains forward because you control so much capital. That old company that you then sold down to the presidency, you can quickly shift a better train to it, then buy back up its stocks.
Yes.
Right. And so then this also gives you a significant share lead. And a share lead is when people are really in trouble, when they really are behind.
Yeah.
So let's say I go like this. I float a company, I spend all its money, I buy my own private, I sell my stuff down to the presidency, now I've got a bunch of money to float another company. I float another company immediately, burn through the trains. Let's say I rush the trains in my other company, but I pass it a better train from this company, right? And then you kind of rinse and repeat this process.
Okay.
But then once I have money again, I can buy back up into the company that maybe I've now given it a permanent train, and now I buy back up. Mm. But I won't buy the shares that I've put in the bank pool. I'll buy the shares from the IPO.
Okay.
From the initial offering, right?
Right.
Because shares in the bank pool pay to the company.
Yes.
So what I do is now I buy the shares from the offering and I leave those shares in the bank pool. Now that company has a nice fancy train. Now I back up to 50% of it. Now I'm running it. So now it's running a good route because it's got a better train than anyone else. And it's getting more money into its treasury to push more trains, to token the map, to get other people out. So you're controlling a lot of money here. Mm. Right. So that is what's considered a capital control strategy.
Okay.
And that's kind of the rough skeleton of how it works.
Okay.
Right. So how do you think one would counter a capital control strategy?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is to do the exact same thing, to also sell down to just the president share and also float a second company. So let's say you're limited to 5 or 6 companies in the game. And you're doing the capital control strategy, then I think I would do the same, just so that you don't have 4 of the 6 companies, so that we maybe have 3 each, or something like that, you know. The other thing you could potentially maybe do is to, after you've sold shares to the bank pool, is I could buy them once they've dropped before you start buying them back up, to take that money, then is to buy from the bank pool to take that money out of the company.
So the problem with that would be that now you're spending money buying my old shares, but you're not gaining control of capital by doing that. Yeah. So are you then allowing me to freely continue to increase my control of the capital in the game?
Okay, I see.
So the two main counters, from what I understand to this, or the two main ways you could potentially combat this, first off is buy my shares that I'm, like, let's say I float my first or my second company, buy shares in that company and then sell them to the bank pool. Remember, you can't sell more than 50%.
Oh, of course.
Okay. So then I can't sell down to the presidency and I'm stuck with maybe 40% of a company.
Okay, yes.
So I'm less able to just offload a bunch of it to float the new company.
Mm, mm.
So in that way, you are denying me access to additional capital.
Okay.
So it's all about limiting my control over the capital in the game. The other big thing you can do is you can par one of the other companies before me at a lower price. So because I'm essentially escalating the price, so let's say I par it at, I don't know, I can't remember the exact phrase in 1830, but like 76 or 82, I think there's those 90, 100, I think those are the values somewhere around there. But there's also 71 and 67, I think.
Okay.
Might have actually got those right. Yeah, so those are the kind of the values. So you can just par a company at 67, for example, which denies me access to increasing a huge amount of capital. I can't now par it at 90. Once it's been parred, it's stuck there.
Yes.
Whether I float it or not is irrelevant.
So I par it without floating it in that case.
Even potentially, I think you could even potentially do that. Yeah.
Okay.
Because then if I wanted to float it, I could, but I'm again getting 670 from the bank instead of 900.
Right.
And it becomes a less attractive investment
for me. That's interesting.
Yeah. So it's basically about limiting, stopping me from controlling all this capital.
Okay.
Yeah. So there are ways, obviously, to counter this.
Mm.
But I think it's a strategy that works particularly well against inexperienced players because they are very unlikely to do any of that.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
And the other one?
So that's capital control. So capital control is about controlling the most amount of money. Capital destruction is quite interesting because you are burning your own position along with everybody else's. You're basically devaluing everything and putting everyone in a tough spot. But as JC puts it, you control the critical dollar. You control one more dollar than everyone else, or you have one more dollar than everyone else, and all you need to win the game is one more dollar than everyone else, essentially.
Okay.
So capital destruction is kind of the opposite. That's where you are trashing stocks, where you are limiting the liquidity in the game. You are pushing through the trains quickly, potentially rusting trains quickly, but a lot of basically devaluing people's shares.
Okay.
So you are trying to kind of better your own position by sort of devaluing everyone else's.
Okay.
As well. And yeah, it's kind of putting everyone in a little bit of a tough spot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So capital destruction works pretty poorly to some extent against capital control.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
I don't know if I quite get it yet.
Yeah.
I might have to think about it a bit more.
I might have to think about it a bit too.
But it's, yeah, something to look out for. I'll definitely pay close attention to what you do next in the next game.
Yeah, so I feel like capital control, I kind of understand. I feel like capital destruction is tricky in terms of how I would actually go about it, right? So basically what you're trying to do is you're trying to destroy stock value. You are reducing everyone else's position in terms of their value. And you want to basically rush liabilities faster than anyone right. else.
So I can see if you think you have a lead, then you can just basically crash the game by arresting all the trains and forcing the game to an end, and you'll still maintain your lead. Even though everyone's doing worse, you'll still right. maintain your lead.
So the way you could do this is to consistently par companies very low,
mm.
to try par a lot of companies and to par them very low.
Okay.
So you're limiting the amount of liquidity, the amount of capital coming into the game,
mm.
but you control more than others.
Mm.
So then you will rush through the trains and put everyone else in a really tough spot because they don't have access to companies. They don't have access to money to par them at high prices. Mm. So you're essentially rushing through the game before people can buy trains, before they can run routes, before they can even withhold if they need to.
Mm.
So you basically are devaluing people's stock. So let's say I buy a bunch of your stock, right?
Mm.
Then I sell a bunch of it. I get my money back. You don't, though. You are now going to really struggle to get your money back for that stock. So you now can't sell that stock to par another company because your stock is pretty worthless.
Okay.
Also, I've kind of filled up the bank pool with some of your stuff,
yes.
which makes it harder for you to sell down. But I use the money that I've gained from trashing your stock to par another company, but I par it low.
Mm.
I parred very low. The lowest is 67, I think, right? Mm. So I parred at 67 and I just start burning through trains. And then I par another one and I do the same thing. So my position kind of sucks here.
Mm.
I'm in trouble, but I'm in less trouble than you.
Yes. Yeah.
So that's why it's called capital destruction. I'm not putting myself in a great position, but as long as I have $1 more than everyone else, I win.
Yeah, that's enough. Yeah.
Exactly, right? So I basically want to watch the world burn. So I think I'm remembering now kind of or getting a grasp of how this kind of works.
Okay.
Right. So just by talking about it a little bit more and just remembering my conversations with JC as well. So, yeah. So does that make sense to you?
Kind of. I get the difference. I don't quite get how it'll play out and how, yeah.
I think it'll require a bit of experimentation.
Yes.
Definitely. But essentially what you're doing is, yeah, you basically are just forcing liabilities. Liabilities in this case mostly being on the hook to buy trains.
Yes.
So you're forcing those liabilities. You are minimizing the amount of liquidity in the game by parring companies for a crappy price.
Mm.
So there's much less capital flowing in, but you control more of it than other people.
Mm.
You are dumping other people's stocks, trying to devalue their stock price because that denies them access to money to sort of get them out of the mess,
okay.
essentially. And you're also rushing through this stuff faster than people can run routes and collect revenues and withhold if they need to or whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
So people's income in general is very low.
Okay.
Yours is low too.
Yeah.
But you just are a little bit more in control.
All right. Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. So you are basically destroying the value of the capital on the board.
Mm.
Capital in this case being the stocks, being the money coming from the bank.
Mm.
So there's very little money coming from the bank. The stock values are really low.
Yes.
So you're creating this kind of poverty at the table.
Right.
And you are a part of that poverty,
but
a little bit less than everyone else.
Okay. That could be an interesting one for a game where bankruptcy ends the game.
Yeah.
Where so you just basically end the game early by someone goes bankrupt and then you count the money and you have $10 more than anyone else.
I think that may be a pretty core part of how it works. Yes.
Yeah.
I think it will likely force a game to end in bankruptcy.
Mm.
And I think you will have very little money, but you will just have more shares and more value than everyone else because their shares are going to be worth less than yours.
Okay.
How to counteract such a strategy? I don't know. I guess you just fight back.
Yeah.
Maybe you just do the same thing back, or just try and recognize it and try and get in front of it. I'm actually not very sure.
Yes. Yeah, I don't know either.
I think that...
Par high.
Yeah, I think just that... I believe, though, and I said this earlier, that a capital control strategy can be a good response to a capital destruction strategy. Mm. And I could see how that works.
Yeah.
Because if someone's trying to destroy the value of the capital, if you control more of it, you win.
Yes.
Because essentially what the destructive player is also trying to do is also trying to control more, but a tiny bit more.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so you can try and seize control of the game by quickly floating companies before they can as well.
Right. Yeah.
And try and take that access away from them. Mm. To sort of, because they need money to destroy the value of capital, right? Because they're trying to buy up other stuff and then trash it and get ahead in that way.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So you see why I sort of say these are quite offensive strategies in a way.
Mm. Yeah.
They are very much an attack on other players.
Yes.
And it's an attempt to really kind of seize control of the game,
right,
rather than to just try and be the best performing player at the table.
Yes. Okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely a lot to think about there.
Yeah, so this is something that I would certainly like to revisit, especially once I've had to try it practically.
Yes.
Like I say, this is just information. I've seen JC refer to these terms. I asked him a little bit about it. I did some Googling and dug up some old threads and stuff where people discuss it and things like that. They're not extremely commonly used terms, I don't think. I think JC is the one who uses these terms the most. Mm. But I do think they encompass a particular kind of strategy.
Okay.
Yeah, and I thought that'd be kind of fun to discuss in the sense that, yeah, maybe people listening can try them out.
Yes.
As well, if they haven't before.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, and I think it's just a different way to think about the game, maybe.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think there is a lot to think about there.
Sure. Yeah, so yeah. Maybe we'll come back to it once we have
tried it out.
Once you've given it a try. Yeah.
Yes, yeah, in Saturday.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm trying to think if that's one of the games where you kind of could. Mm. I think you could probably do the control bits.
Okay.
I think the stock only goes down one per if you sell a bunch of shares. So.
Oh, right.
Okay. But you could probably control the capital. So I'll keep my eye on you, Frey.
Cool.
Yeah, man. So do you wanna move on to our game here?
Okay, sure.
Our Afrikaans game.
Yeah.
So Afrikaans is a very funny language.
It is one of the best languages to swear in.
Yeah, absolutely. But what I love about Afrikaans is they have a lot of words that are incredibly descriptive. Mm. So people often refer to Afrikaans as a descriptive language.
It is, yeah.
And that's because a lot of terms in Afrikaans will describe something in a very literal way.
Yeah.
And they also have a lot of funny terms for things. So I've taken my favorite funny Afrikaans term. So I'm going to read you the Afrikaans word, maybe poorly. We'll see how it goes. I'll give you the direct translation, and then I'm going to let you think about it a little bit, and then I'll come back and tell you.
Well, you can let me give the direct translation.
What it is. Yeah, you can give the direct translation. I'll tell you if it matches what I have over here.
Okay.
Yeah, so...
Well, maybe it would be cool to see if I actually know these words, being Afrikaans.
Yes, yeah.
Because sometimes not these things aren't always used in like everyday language.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. They're just kind of like funny terms.
Yes.
But so these terms are either funny because of their descriptive nature. Afrikaans terms also really like making terms that rhyme, I've found as well.
It's like alliteration or something.
Yes,
as well,
yeah. Yeah. Or like things that rhyme in some way. Or yeah. So.
Okay.
There's that as well. Okay, cool. Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay. Your first word is swerk awesome.
Swerk awesome.
Yes. What is the direct translation of swerk awesome?
Ghost breath.
Ghost breath. Okay, I'm going to give everyone a chance to think about what ghost breath is, and then I'm going to come back to these at the end and I'll tell you what all of them mean.
Okay.
So you can pause it if you like and give it some thought if you want to turn it into a game. If you just want to skip to the end, then yeah,
okay.
We'll meet you at the end. Okay. Fruteldoos.
Fruteldoos.
Fruteldoos. Remember, direct translation. Don't give it away.
That is actually a word that I know from Afrikaans, but I never use it. Oh, okay. I think I know what it is. But fruteldoos directly translated would be like, what is the English word for frittle? It's like...
So what I've got is fiddle box.
Yeah, fiddle. Yeah, that's a good word. Yeah.
Okay, fiddle box.
Yeah, that's a good direct translation.
So everyone, what is a fiddle box? Think about it. Okay, next one is skouerflich.
Skouerflich.
Yeah.
Can you show me? Or can you spell it?
Skouervlieg.
Oh, skouervlieg. I haven't actually heard that one, but I think I like know what it means.
Okay, the direct translation you should know though, right?
Shoulder fly,
exactly.
Yes.
Okay, shoulder fly, everyone. Okay, knatter flatter.
Also not a word I would use.
This is veering close to swear word territory, but I don't think we'll have to mark this as explicit for this
one.
Oh,
man. Knatter flatter. Like a ball mistake?
Yes, balls failure is what I've got here.
Balls failure. Okay.
Balls failure.
Okay.
Okay. So maybe you can think about what a balls failure might be, but it's kind of in there already. Okay. Next one is rond cake twak.
So that is look around. Twak can mean different things. Nonsense, like nonsense, or
it says here tobacco.
Tobacco, it could be tobacco as well.
Okay. Yeah. Ron cake twak is look around tobacco.
Yes.
Okay, so give that one some thought.
Okay.
Next one is pap brook.
Okay. Yeah. That means like slacks.
Exactly. Yeah, what I have here is flat pants.
Okay.
But pup is like, yeah, pup is a very...
Like not firm, not stiff, yes.
Yeah, so something like soft and saggy.
So I would go with slacks.
Yeah, slacks I like more. Okay, but if you're playing at home, flat pants is what we got here. Okay, the last one is, you could probably translate this one actually, people listening. Papier vampire.
Paper vampire.
Okay, What do you think a paper vampire is? Okay, we're back to the beginning. Okay. Fred, Spork Awesome, Ghost Breath.
Okay, so that is candy floss.
Candy floss, if you're in America, you'll call it cotton candy.
Cotton candy, yes.
Yeah. So that's one of an example of Afrikaans being very descriptive.
And that one of your list is the one that gets used, like... That is actually what we call it every day.
Like, but don't you love that ghost breath? Yeah, I mean, that's amazing.
It is quite descriptive of that's what it amazing. Looks like.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. Yes. Okay. How about the frittelduis, the fiddle box?
That is the like a cubbyhole in a car.
Exactly.
But so Afrikaans people would often just call it a cubbyhole. So Afrikaans uses a lot of English words in everyday language as well. But frittelduis, like I know the words, but I would probably just say cubbyhole.
They wouldn't call it a duis. Duis is kind of a swear word in Afrikaans.
It can be, yeah.
Even though it just means box, yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So make of that what you will. Okay, yeah, cubbyhole for the Americans, glove compartment.
Yeah, glove box, something like that.
What you guys call it, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Skoflich, shoulder fly.
So that one I haven't actually heard, but I would guess that it's like a backseat driver.
It is. Well done.
So, but the way I understand the word is it basically means someone that's on your shoulder, like so looking over your shoulder as you drive or just doing something.
Absolutely. Yeah. But a shoulder fly is a great description for a backseat driver. Yeah. So that's why I love these. They're so descriptive. Okay. A knatter flatter, a balls failure. So it's kind of a it's kind of right in there. The actual meaning is written as a balls up. Yeah.
Okay.
A mistake.
Okay.
A cock up.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. A balls up. Okay, rond cake twak, look around tobacco.
That, I would guess, would be weed.
It is weed, yeah.
Because it's something you smoke but makes you maybe a little bit...
looking around.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's weed, marijuana, whatever you want to call it. Paprook, flat pants.
That means you're broke, have no money.
Ooh, that's not what I have.
Oh, really? What do you have? Yeah, I'm wrong.
I have coward.
That I was kind of, I almost said that actually.
Okay, so it must have rung in there somewhere because I think that's a pretty hard one.
I'm trying to think. It's not one I use. I mean, I've definitely heard it, but it's not a one I use. We would just say chicken.
So apparently coward. And the last one of my favorites, papier vampire, a paper vampire.
That would be like a stapler.
A stapler.
Yes.
Yeah. So I feel like people might have got that one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it does make sense. Yeah.
It does make sense. Yeah. Very descriptive.
Yes.
Also love that one as well.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. So that was a fun game.
It was.
Hope you guys enjoyed that. Even Fred had managed to make a game out of it for himself. So. Yeah, but thank you so much, everyone, for listening. We appreciate it.
Yes, thank you.
Please, yeah, send us emails, tweets, Instagrams. We haven't been telling people what that is for a while, I don't think. So if you do want to send us an email, it's derailed18xx@gmail.com. Our Twitter is @derailed18xx, and I think our Instagram is
the same, @derailed18xx, yes.
Consistency.
Yeah.
Nicely done. Yeah. But yeah, thank you so much, everyone, for tuning in. We always appreciate it, and we hope you enjoyed the episode.
Yes.
Thanks. And yeah, we'll catch you next week to talk about 1847.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
Cheers.
Cheers.